Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of Recovery Radio. I'm Johnny. In the studio with me today is Christina, and Christina is a participant in the Celebrate Recovery program, which I believe is where Denise and her connected most recently. So Christina, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Fantastic. Why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about how you wound up in Moscow, or your travels in your life up to this point, and then we'll get into your story.
Sounds good. Well, I came to Moscow first in 2004 to attend at the University of Idaho. I left for a brief period and came back in 2008, married, and my husband enrolled at the university. By the time he was done, we looked around and thought, well, we have jobs, we have friends, and moving is really hard. Let's just stay here. And
sure.
Have been here ever since.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Yeah, I'm a transplant from Northern California. Don't ask me.
That's
why.
That's a good change.
I swear to God, I was sober when we made that decision, and so was my wife. But not that you can't grow to regret things in time. No, I love Moscow. I love this town. I love the people. I love Idaho in general. It's gorgeous. So let's roll into your story of recovery. What it was like before. What happened to get you in, and then
where you are
now.
I can tell you all about that, Johnny.
Fabulous.
Well, like I mentioned, I'm not from the area. My family is actually back down in Oregon. I have three siblings, grew up on a dairy farm, a little southern Idaho type town. It's just on the other side of the border, so I consider it to be more like southern Idaho than Oregon per se.
Right.
And I grew up in a really isolated kind of situation out on the farm, being homeschooled with just my parents and my siblings and maybe the cows for company. I didn't really understand a lot about the bigger world. I thought everything I experienced was normal, even though it actually was kind of broken, kind of a tough experience at times. There was some substance abuse in my family where my dad was pretty heavily involved, and my mom was put in a position to take care of the family mostly by herself. She shouldered a lot of the responsibility for taking care of the family, providing income. I'm trying to think of a different word for food, but that's the only word I'm coming up with right
now. Sure. food's a good word. It's in the dictionary.
Basic needs, right. You know, food, clothing, shelter, education. Mom took on a lot of responsibility for that. But since that's a pretty tough burden to shoulder by yourself, it meant she was working a lot. So with Dad and his addictions and Mom overcompensating to take care of that, I really felt like an orphan more than anything else. I felt like my basic needs were being met, but I was alone. There was my older sister and our two younger siblings that were so much younger. We were kind of in a parental role over them without a whole lot of adult supervision to teach us about how the world worked and what life was going to be like.
Right. Life skills, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So even when I needed structure to my day, it just wasn't there. I thought it was really normal to eat whenever I wanted, whatever I wanted, sleep from midnight to 10 a.m. when I was 8, basically do anything I wanted until it annoyed Dad. Then he came out of his den to administer spankings. Otherwise, my home life was really chaotic. And there really wasn't anybody on the outside to see what was going on at home.
Yeah, that's a big concern right now with schools not being open, as evidently a whole bunch of child abuse
mm-hmm.
Is caught by teachers and counselors in schools. And right now, it's really a frightful thing. They don't know how bad it really could be. So, they absolutely understand that without any outside influence to, call people on things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've heard that that's really tough with the spousal abuse and isolation, too. Tempers get high, and when your spouse is the only one to take it out on, that can be a really dangerous situation. So there's my first life lesson about how life doesn't work the way I was taught it was like, is I need other people in my life. I can't do life by myself. Humans are meant to live in community.
Right, and children are not inherently equipped to deal with adult emotions, adult reactions, things like drug abuse. My parents were both alcoholics. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I absolutely relate to that.
Yeah. I do wish I could have had a different experience growing up, but this is what I get. This is what I get to deal with. And there's nothing to be done about the past but to learn from it and move on from there. In my situation, a lot of what I learned were unrealistic expectations that kind of defied reality. So in my family, I learned things like feelings are not allowed. You should take pride in your inability to feel. You should never need help, but always help a family member at your own expense. I also learned that women's only value was in her sex appeal, but personal hygiene is a vain activity. I also learned that even though cookies are a primary food group in our house, you should always be thinner. I learned that children should be seen and not heard. Wait, maybe you shouldn't be seen either. The most detrimental thing I learned in my family was that love means we can treat you like dirt and you have to be okay with it. The only way to be happy is to get married. So even though love isn't a good thing, it's an excuse for bad behavior, you should still be aspiring for that in your life. This is the goal of life. So the overarching conclusion out of all these false beliefs that I was taught was that, well, I am a pile of garbage, so I have no hope of attracting a nice man, but I need to get married or I'm going to be unhappy forever.
And those are, again, goes back to children not really having the capacity to figure these things out, whether that's really right or really wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so we draw conclusions based on what we see.
Mm-hmm.
And if what we see is all messed up, we're willing to take that as fact.
Well, it's normal to us. It's the only reality we've ever known.
That's right.
So since I was determined to go find a nice Christian boy, I did. I met a boy on a missions trip. Before I had left for the trip, my older sister told me that, well, this was my last chance to find a good Christian boy, even though I was 16 at the time. But this was my last chance to go find a nice Christian boy, and since I was determined to do it, I did. I met a boy and decided that he was going to be my Prince Charming, whether he liked it or not.
I see, okay.
And so I pursued a relationship with him without regard for my personal well-being. So that was actually the part of my story where I left Moscow for a while, was to go pursue the relationship with him on the East Coast. I have never heard God speak to me so clearly in my life as when I was contemplating the decision to move back east. So clearly I heard God tell me, "No, Christina, don't move. You stay here, don't do this dumb thing." And I went, I'm doing it anyway, God. So in a lot of ways, I chose my idol over my God, and I paid dearly for that. The time I spent living back east in that relationship, I consider that to be my personal ski trip to hell. No part of my life was undamaged by that decision. My dad spent that whole summer in intensive care in the hospital back home, and I couldn't get home to do anything about it. the only job I could get wasn't enough to pay the bills, so I was living myself into debt. I couldn't afford to eat, so I didn't, and my weight probably got below 100 pounds. I honestly don't have a number to tell you on that, but I can tell you I saw bones I didn't know I had sticking out.
Oh my, okay.
That was an experience. And since I really didn't have a church community or friends, and my boyfriend's family was mildly hostile towards me, I really had no social support over there. So my only social support person was my boyfriend, which put him in a really prime position to force unwanted sexual contact on me. And so the moral of the story again is, it is not good to be alone. That was definitely a low point in my life where I felt too ashamed of my decisions to go back to God, but I also had nowhere else to go. At the end of that, I did choose to marry my boyfriend because, well, this is my consequence. This is what I chose. I'm going to do the thing because I committed to doing the thing. But was that a good consequence? I don't know. I did it. I wouldn't do it again.
Good old 2020 hindsight.
Yeah, but, yeah.
But we all have to go through what we went through,
mm-hmm.
to, you know, make us what we are today. At least that's what I believe. I mean, sometimes I can look back at things I did that were either just foolish or downright detrimental and say, oh, okay, had I not done that, you know, it may have just been time before I did it again anyway. And the mm-hmm. fact that it happened when mm-hmm. it did, it's like a lot of my friends got, you know, busted for minor in possession.
Mm-hmm.
But when they turned 18, that could get cleaned off their records. Where if it had happened at 19, mm. well, then you're old enough to go in the army and die and vote. But you don't get to expunge that youthful dalliance off of your mm-hmm. record, so you're stuck.
Yeah.
So I understand that.
There is a lot of value in experiences. Not going to discount that. But we're not to the point in the story where I start caring about that yet, Johnny. You're getting ahead of me here.
Perfect. Well, I'll let you go on.
So after I married him, I decided that I needed to come back to the last place where I had felt at peace with God, and that was back in Moscow, Idaho. So we packed up and moved back here. He enrolled at the university, and I wanted things to work. I wanted life to be good, but I knew something wasn't. So I began dabbling in recovery with self-help books. I started with things like Codependent No More and The Emotionally Abusive Relationship. Because I knew something was not right, I just didn't know how to fix it.
And you were in you mentioned a church community a couple of times. When you were young, were you involved in a church community? You talked something about a mission trip.
Oh, that's right. I grew up attending a church mostly due to my grandfather's influence in the family.
Okay.
So I did grow up in the church. I did find faith in God, and that was a really powerful source of comfort. Even in all the chaos, I could trust that even if my father and mother forsake me, God will receive me. That's Psalm 27:10, in case you were wondering.
It sounded familiar.
It's a good one, right?
Yes, absolutely. They're mostly good ones. Except spare the rod and spoil the child. That still confused me. And I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, it's all good.
But I think that's, you know, a significant thing, that even at a young age you had enough exposure to some sort of spiritual program
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that you were able to keep reaching back to that. So please go on.
Sure. So I knew something was not right, didn't know what it was, and then just before my fourth anniversary, I stumbled upon Prince Charming's Destructive Habit, and that hurt so much, broke my heart to the core. I found the thing that was wrong, and that was a really tough pill. to swallow. I really tried to handle the pain constructively. I tried even more self-help books like Every Heart Restored and The Power of a Praying Wife. I tried counseling both with pastors and with professionals, by myself and with him. I prayed and prayed. I did art therapy. I did Bible studies. I did antidepressants. I did mega dose vitamins. I even had cosmetic surgery twice to try and make myself into the ideal woman I believed he wanted. We tried marriage mentoring. I wrote a 50,000 word essay about how crummy my life was, and none of those healthy coping mechanisms helped. So I tried the unhealthy things too. I stopped eating. I immersed myself in work so that I didn't have to think about the truth. I emotionally withdrew from everybody because I felt like I couldn't besmirch my husband's reputation by telling our mutual friends about it. I tried to build a different support community by joining my coworkers at the bar after work. I dabbled in self-harm and contemplated suicide again. I was trapped in the lie of pretending that everything was okay even when it wasn't. That was when I hated being alive so much that I decided having children would be unspeakably cruel. So I chose the merciful option and got sterilized. I resigned myself to just existing. Well, this is the way it is. I'm just gonna survive. I know how to do that. I can just survive. And at that point, my only hope was in Isaiah 64:17, where God promises, "Behold, I will create a new heavens and a new earth. The former things will not be remembered, nor will they come to mind." I just wanted to not remember this anymore. So that was my hope. It was near that time that I found Celebrate Recovery. I was working as a cake decorator, and one of my friends asked if I would decorate her wedding cake. I thought, sure, this will be fine. I love my friend. I love cakes. I'm gonna make her a beautiful cake. And I did. But I spent the whole day of her wedding so angry at how my life had turned out. I knew I couldn't keep going on the way things were. I needed something different. And I thought of a friend who attended Celebrate Recovery. And I thought of her and thought, I need to talk to her. I don't know why her, but I needed to talk to this friend about how awful I feel right now. And she wasn't available when I called, but she did invite me to start attending at Celebrate Recovery. And I had heard about the program a couple of months before that and had thought about, well, maybe. But this time I had the motivation to actually go. I attended my first meeting in August of 2013, and it was scary. I'm not gonna lie, it was terrifying. There were the first couple of weeks I went where all I could say was, "Hi, I'm Christina. I'm scared to be here." And that was it. But I could see the honesty in the other participants there. I could see lives being changed, and I knew I needed to try it for myself. In a cynical kind of way, I thought, well, I've already done everything else I can think of to do. Why not try this too? If it doesn't work, I'll just put it on the big list of things that doesn't work and it'll be fine.
Absolutely can relate to, you know, the experience of going in. My first AA meeting, I could not walk up to the door and turn the handle to walk in. Mm-hmm. I saw people laughing, joking, drinking coffee, smoking cigarettes, just seemed to be really happy, and I was just petrified. Mm-hmm. Until a man came out and said, "Are you looking for an AA meeting?" I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Well, come on in."
That's kind.
It's God sends us angels, mm-hmm, to drag us where we need to go.
I like that.
At least that's how it worked for me. Mm-hmm. And once I got in there, I sat in the back. Mm-hmm. I didn't say anything, mm-hmm, for the first few meetings. And that first time that I said, "My name's Johnny and I am an alcoholic," I came very close to crying. Mm-hmm. I think I was tearing up. And that's all I said. Mm-hmm. So, boy, yeah, no, I understand how that first time going in, scared, just panicked even.
Yeah.
Not knowing, you know, what this is or how it's going to work. But I had the same, a very similar feeling. My mother, in the last 10 years of her life, got sober. Mm-hmm. And she got sober in AA. Looking back on it, she didn't work a really hardy program, but just being around those people mm-hmm. turned her into somebody I had never known in 40 years.
You know, I think part of what intimidated me about it was feeling like I needed a label to be able to walk in. But I didn't have something easy like, well, I'm an alcoholic. I just said, I'm messed up and I don't know why.
My life's a disaster.
Yeah,
I'm embarrassed by it and
But really, that's not what I needed. I just needed to get better. I think it's absolutely acceptable to walk into a meeting and say, I just want to be healthier. I don't necessarily need a label. I just want to be healthier.
Right. And in a certain way, when a true alcoholic like me, you know, says, I'm an alcoholic, mm-hmm. it's actually, for me, it's a relief because now I know what's wrong. Because now I understand what alcoholism is. Mm-hmm. I know what being an alcoholic is. Before I got to AA, I was just a garden variety drunk. But now I'm an alcoholic. And now I know what I need to do to stay healthy. Mm-hmm. But I understand the idea of labeling. Mm-hmm. Because it can be, in the wrong hands, it can be used as a cudgel. And mm-hmm. that's not okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's what has kept people out of recovery for eons.
Feeling like, well, I'm not messed up enough to need recovery, but as one of my good friends there said, does it really matter if you have an inch of mud or 6 feet of mud on you? You still need a bath. So I decided that was what I needed to do, and a step study opened shortly after I started attending, so I jumped in with both feet, signed up for that, and during that process of applying the steps and principles to my life, I learned that I wasn't attending for what I thought I was. I thought I was going to deal with the pain of decisions that other people had made for me, but I learned there was actually a lot of underlying problems that needed taken care of first, such as what I believe about where I get value from, what I believe God is like, and I needed to dispel the lies that I had accepted as the truth. I had to learn that it's okay to feel bad when things aren't okay. I've had to learn that God is actually a nice guy. I've had to learn that it doesn't really matter what my family thinks about my decisions and that the world isn't the terrifying, hostile place that I had been led to believe that it was. One of the biggest challenges I faced in that first step study was how I was defining the word love. It was one of my biggest challenges in recovery because my life experiences had taught me that love means I can treat you like garbage and you should be thankful that I'm paying attention to you at all. So I really had a hard time connecting with the idea of God's love from that perspective. I saw one counselor who tried to define it for me as there is no greater love than to lay down one's life for one's friends, which is John 15:13, in case you were wondering. But that definition perpetuated a codependent mindset for me. It didn't help me define what healthy love was supposed to be like. It was a really dramatic experience for me when God led me to the beginning of Romans 13:10 as a definition of love. That states, love does no harm to its neighbor. So learning to replace my broken definition of love with a true definition was a big shift in my thinking. One of my biggest fears in coming to recovery was that my parents would find out that I had been sterilized. I thought if I admitted it, they'd somehow magically find out. And actually, they did. That was a disaster. But even though it was the thing I was most afraid of, God didn't let me down in that. I was surrounded with my friends from recovery who encouraged me. And I came to the realization that I needed to care more about what God thought than what my parents thought. Since I'm no longer bound by that secret, I can move forward in my life with honesty. I will never physically have children, but that doesn't determine my value.
Why don't we take just a short break here, because I think we're getting to the point where you're starting your healing.
And, yeah, that sounds about right.
And we want to emphasize that, because, you know, I think you understand that just because we recognize and get a true vision of what is holding us back, what's holding us down, and making us miserable, is not enough. Mm-hmm. We have to start developing those mm-hmm. tools to be able to move forward and
That's
move
so
on
true.
And past it. So we'll take a little break for a minute and we'll come back and finish up.
Sounds good.
You're listening to KRFP 90.3, the coolest station in the nation.
After all the jets are in the boxes, and the clowns have all gone to bed, you can hear happiness staggering on down the street. Footprints dressed in red, and the wind whispers merrily. A broom is drearily sweeping up the broken pieces of yesterday's life. Somewhere a queen is weeping, somewhere a king has no wife. And the wind, it cries very.
She's been telling us about her life leading up to her decision to join in with Celebrate Recovery. And Celebrate Recovery is a program that works on hurts, habits, and hang-ups. And basically, Christina was just telling us about some of the revelations she got on helping her adjust her thinking about why those things happened and how those things happened, and getting a true version of what was going on in her life. So Christina, thanks for being here again. And why don't we roll on to talking about your building your tools and what your life has become since you got into recovery.
Sure thing, Johnny. I think the most valuable tool I gained in recovery was the sense of community. Seeing other people struggling with the same things, watching other people fight the same battles, has been the most useful thing for me. There's a surprising amount of power in being able to sit down with somebody and have them say, yeah, me too. It's very freeing. It's very refreshing. It's encouraging to know that this thing that is trying to crush me, someone else is struggling with it too, and they made it. There's hope for me. Someone else has made it. I can do this too.
And I'm not alone.
Yeah.
That loneliness you talked about as a child, being alone, and you're not.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's an amazing experience. So being able to recognize when I'm believing things that are not true, and having a support group, having a community around me, has helped me with a lot of other situations as life has continued to grow and develop. I feel like some of the things that have come up in my life since I started recovery, I couldn't have handled before. Like I mentioned earlier, when my parents found out I had gotten sterilized, I couldn't have handled that before recovery, before I had a strong support group. Another thing that came up was just after my 10th anniversary, my husband told me that he hated God and needed to leave me. So instead of turning back to all the unhealthy coping mechanisms I had had before I could reach to my church and my friends for support, I could reach towards others instead of pulling away and back into loneliness, back into destructive habits. Even when the thing I had aspired to the most in my life fell through, I wasn't alone. I could still deal with that situation. When I decided to start dating again after that divorce went through, I could approach my new boyfriend as an equal, not from a place above him in codependent rescuing or from a place beneath him as a subservient idolatry, but as a peer with more options than just, I need to marry this person and that's the way it is. When my boyfriend confessed to having the same destructive habit as my ex, I had been through enough life to offer no judgment. In recovery, I learned that a person's struggle is simply a behavior, it's not their identity. While I hate the destructive habit very much, I have learned to differentiate that it's not who he is and can offer mercy as one who has been forgiven much. I can see his struggle as just a struggle and not something I need to take responsibility for. So in short, I've learned that I get to decide what I will and won't accept in a relationship.
Boundaries.
Yeah. Went much better than round one.
I can only imagine. Yeah, it's tough when you run the world. It's a tough job.
You know, I just haven't been trained to do that. Just don't know what I'm doing. I really do appreciate what God has brought me through in all this. From being a high school dropout, he brought me through college to graduate with a bachelor's degree. From being on both unhealthy extremes of the weight spectrum and hating myself at both of them, he has taught me how to accept myself and be all right with my body just being what it is. From defining my value by my appearance and my accomplishments, I've learned to define success as my willingness to do the next right thing with my Lord. From depending on my family for approval, he has reminded me that he is the true God in my life, not them. from being completely alone and thus accepting bad relationships out of desperation, he has brought me to a community to learn how to cultivate healthy relationships. From wishing that bad things in my life hadn't happened, he's given me a new vision in the form of a question of what would it look like if that were completely healed? Not what if that thing had never happened, but what if this were completely healed? And from being so fearful that I didn't want to be around anybody, he has given me the courage to be here sharing my story today.
There you go. Like we were talking about during the break, sometimes we're not technically in the studio. We're in a remote location at the recovery center, and just the environment here, you know, tends to put people at ease. Where I've seen people who are not as, let's say, advanced in their recovery as you are, totally go panic and tongue-tied when they walk into a radio studio with all the lights and the mixing boards and microphones hanging from wires and all that. So, yeah, no, that's absolutely something to celebrate, especially when you've been the quiet mouse in the corner.
Yeah, I'm still not where I want to be in life. There are still things where I'm learning and growing. There are still broken things in my circumstances. But I've learned that my strength is in trust and truth, not in hiding. So even though I'm not where I want to be, praise God, I'm not where I was.
In AA, in the Big Blue Book, the book Alcoholics Anonymous, there is a passage that says, we will not forget the past nor want to close the door on it. And the reason for that is I need to remember that because I can go back there like the snap of my fingers.
It comes back fast.
All I would have to do is forget that I can't have just that first drink. And I can be right back there because I've had relapses. And each one has been short and miserable.
Short and unfulfilling, huh?
Absolutely. Absolutely unfulfilling. Debilitating. And, you know, so I don't want to forget that. I don't want to forget that all it took was one drink to put me back in that space. Not where I left off, but it's as though my, you know, addiction, that baby tiger, he didn't die when I quit drinking. He's been in the corner feeding on my occasional anger, my inability to absolutely give up, resentments. And he's getting bigger and stronger all the time. So I hear people say, you know I have another drunk in me, but I don't know if I have another recovery in me.
Another sober in me.
that's it's not frightening to me anymore. It's just very real. And it's just like I'm not afraid of going back to where I was.
Now I know how to get out.
I just have a choice. I have a choice now. I didn't have a choice then. As long as I understand, I can choose not to do something. I can be okay with that. I don't have to find myself struck drunk again. And, you know, that's something that happens. I find myself repeating bad behavior. Not intentionally. It has more to do with maybe I haven't encountered a situation since I got into recovery that it has required me to react to. So I might fall back into the old habit and, lashing out typically is what it is. What's wrong with me? Why'd you cut me off? You know, it's got nothing to do with the fact that Grandma didn't even see me because she can barely see over the steering wheel, and I should just be praying for her that she makes it to Walmart, that she didn't see me when she changed lanes. But at least now, in recovery with a little bit of time, a little bit of experience, I can short circuit that pretty mm-hmm. quickly and just say, oh yeah. So I see a little tuft of blue hair sticking up over the headrest and these two very old knuckles hanging up on the steering. Okay, it's grandma. Yeah, why get upset?
I have heard that on the road to relapse, it's really normal to not see you've taken those steps until the third or fourth step, when the first one is actually the most dangerous.
Right, exactly. But that's, for me, that's been my experience in recovery, using the tools I have and being
aware enough
to know I need to search around in my toolkit before I do anything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting irritated with this person. Okay. Am I hungry, angry, lonely, tired?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I haven't eaten since 6, and it's 4:00 in the afternoon. I didn't get a lot of sleep last night. Yeah, okay. There's something going on there that's not keeping me in my best position. So I'm going to choose not to react. I'm just going to keep an open mind, listen to what this person has to say.
I think that's a really interesting point, because if you know what you want to be, if you have a goal of being a sober Johnny, then you can look at the situations that come up in life and ask yourself, does this action I'm thinking about fit with the goal I want to achieve? And decisions can be boiled down to, does this fit? It's a simple question,
mm-hmm.
but it's a really helpful tool to have in your toolbox.
Right. And that basic pause tool, just mm-hmm. pausing. I am involved in different organizations, and there are organizations where I'm asked for, my opinion. I'm asked to be critical when other people bring up a topic that I'm passionate about. But I still ask myself the three questions.
Mm-hmm.
Does this need to be said? Does this need to be said right now? And does this need to be said right now by me?
Oh, those
and
are good ones.
Usually once I get through those three, I rarely get past the first one. But in the event that I do get past that, yes, I'm very passionate about this. Does it need to be said right now? Well, I could take it offline, talk to the person after the meeting. And by me right now, well, maybe I'll just wait. And sure enough, 90% of the time, if I get to that third one, Bob over here will bring up what I was thinking of,
mm-hmm.
because he has a perspective on it that I don't, that's actually useful in that situation, rather than me just throwing up my hands and going, you're an idiot, what are you thinking?
Right.
And that would have been drunk Johnny's,
mm-hmm.
Or even just non-sober Johnny's reaction to things.
Right.
It's madness. Well, we are just about out of time here. Christina, is there anything you want to throw in at the end? Maybe.
In recovery, we say it's not a quick fix. It's a long process. I like to point out, well, how long did it take me to get this messed up? Of course it's going to take time.
Right. I absolutely agree. I didn't get to the doors of AA for... took me 35 years, so
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
there's a lot of wreckage to clean up there, and I'm still cleaning it up to this day. I've gotten over a lot of the big things, but there's still things that I won't say they keep me awake at night,
mm-hmm.
but when they come into my mind, I know I've got to do something about mm-hmm. them. Got to seek some knowledge, some wisdom to deal with them. And if it's not in the first 164 pages of that big book, I've got a telephone with probably 500 numbers in it
mm-hmm.
that I can start clicking through until somebody has had that experience and has gotten through it. So.
Because you're not alone anymore.
I am not alone. You're right.
So maybe that's my final shout out is from a healthy place with a healthy relationship. I have the best husband in the world. I am so blessed to be with a growing, learning, supportive man.
Fabulous.
So for all the terrible things that I had to go through to get here, I am incredibly blessed to be where I am.
Perfect. And I think that's a perfect note to end on. And this has been Recovery Radio from KRFP in beautiful Moscow, Idaho. And I want you all to remember, if you think you have a problem with drugs or alcohol, hurts, habits, or hang-ups, you do.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be.